This is Hidden Killers Live with Tony Bruschi, Stacey Cole, and Todd Michaels.
Michael McKee has pled not guilty. He's sitting in the Franklin County Jail without bond, facing two counts of aggravated murder, aggravated burglary, and firearm specifications. His defense team now has to look at everything in that unsealed affidavit and figure out what they can challenge, what they can exclude, and how to create reasonable doubt in a case where the court of public opinion has already convicted their client. Eric Faddis, defense attorney, former prosecutor. Obviously, you've been on both sides of this. You know what prosecutors are planning and know how how to defend something like this, too. I mean, to the best extent that one possibly could, and that's what oftentimes a defense attorney has to do. Go in and deal with the car you are dealt. Eric, McKee has pled not guilty and has waived his bail hearing, reserving the right to address bail at a later date. For people watching who don't understand the strategy here, what is the strategy here? Why waive the bail hearing when you're sitting in jail? What does that tell you about how the defense is approaching this case in the early stages?
You know, I'm wondering if perhaps they want to let things cool off a bit. This thing is so in the public eye and there are all these national reports, perhaps sort of letting it die down, letting the temperature go down a little bit. Perhaps they think that might increase their chances of a better ruling, 3 weeks or a month from now, as opposed to now. But that being said, it is a bit of a head scratcher because most defendants who are in custody want to get out immediately. That's not the case for Mr. McKee.
Yeah, that's this is not a good one. This is not one that I think a lot of defense attorneys are going to be super excited to get behind. But he's hired one. He's hired an expensive one, too. One that certainly has her reps in defending high profile cases, defending doctors. Malpractice suit got a doctor off recently. Charged with 14 counts of murder for fentanyl overdoses, and he walked free. So she's got some reps here. She knows how to do this. This is a very different case, though, obviously. When we go back to all of those things that we're hearing, those damning statements from friends of Monique, things that she said, what, as a defense attorney, what is she going to be looking for? As this is obviously going to be something that's going to be litigated and argued for admissibility into a potential trial here, what are the things she is going to be going to the judge with and saying, these can't come into trial, and here is why, other than just it's hearsay and it's from one person to another?
Yeah, I think part of the strategy on defense in a case like this is to try and chip away at the alleged evidence and try to get pretrial rulings that it's going to be inadmissible. So these statements, there is the hearsay issue. There's also the constitutional confrontation clause issue, such that, as a general rule, statements against the defendant cannot be admitted into court unless the declarant, the person who's saying the defendant said that, is there. We don't have that here. So there's a chance they're going to chip away at those statements. On top of that, the ballistics and the firearm that was found, the reports I've read have said that they believe the firearm they found at McKee's residence is similar to the firearm that police believe was used in this crime. That's not conclusive.
No.
And ballistics can be challenged. And so I think that chipping away process is probably happening as we speak.
Is there any way that he walks?
Oh, gosh. I mean,
there's always
so
a way.
I know there's always a way, but my gut is like, this seems like a really dangerous person. If he did these crimes, he is terrifying to have on the streets.
Very true. But perhaps, his attorneys, I'm sure, are doing extensive interviews regarding whether he had an alibi. I know some people think it looks like him on those videos, but is that for sure him? That's still an open question.
Let's talk about his phone, because he thought if it's him, he thought he was like outsmarting everybody by leaving it at his office, at the doctor's office in Rockford at the hospital for 17 hours. You know, while he was, or while someone was out doing this, just happens to be that time that his phone's at a hospital, you know, not really a track record of doing this as far as we know. So it's kind of an outlier. You know, Koberger, we saw, you know, he turned the phone off. People seem to think they're being real tricky when doing this, this sort of thing. Obviously it's better than seeing the GPS going all the way to her house and going all the way back, but he's, you know, the car's caught on camera. It's his car. It's pretty clear it's his car. There's even a sticker that was caught on some of the cameras that was a fairly identifiable mark on the vehicle. And the vehicle now in possession shows where that sticker was. And it's been obviously scraped off. Somebody he saw it, or somebody saw it and went, ooh, kind of identifiable. Maybe I should get rid of it. But it wasn't very good the way they scraped it off. You can tell there was a sticker there. I mean, there's all these little things that he clearly was telling himself with, if I do this, I'll get away with it. They won't catch me. Those often turns out to be like really almost more telling of a mindset than not. How do you think that's going to play? The whole phone thing being turned off and left at the hospital for those 17 hours.
Yeah, you know, one way that it could be interpreted is as concealment, as a person who's trying to hide what they're doing, who knows that, hey, if I bring my phone and it's on, it's going to show my location. So, oh, let me be super sneaky and just leave this at my work. But like you sort of alluded to, Tony, if that is a gross departure from his normal practices, that's going to be a problem. If the prosecution interviews his coworkers, his friends, people in his life, and they're like, hey, does he just like randomly leave his phone at work for like a whole day? Is that something he does? And they'd be like, no, I've never seen him do that. That's going to show, hey, what was the explanation for why he engaged in such a behavioral departure from what he usually does? Was it that he was out going killing these two people?
Do you think it was reconnaissance that he showed up there in December 6th for the early visit? I question if this was his only first visit. I do wonder if he was there a lot of other times and we just don't know about it yet. But let's say it was, you know, it was the only time he's been there other than the 30th. Do you think it was reconnaissance to get to know the house, to get to know where the place was? Or do you think he just showed up and they weren't home and he wasn't able to follow through that day and it ended up being December 30th instead?
Gosh, you know, an ominous inquiry there. It's hard to say, but certainly it would be consistent with you know, other criminals who like case the joint, who you know, learn the layout, learn of the topography of this area, of the neighborhood, everything else. Learn, you know, where the doors are, what doors might appear to have access, what windows might appear to have access. Where am I going to go if I get into this house? How am I going to plan this out? That's typically what that kind of a prior visit might indicate, or was that going to be the fateful day, an even darker consideration?
They say there was no forced entry into the Tepe house. To me, this isn't like a big deal. Maybe it is. Help me understand this better. People leave their doors unlocked all the time. Maybe that's all that happened, but I could see the prosecution trying to argue that means that the victims either you know, knew their killer, or the killer had sophisticated access. Other could have just been they opened the door and it was unlocked. What do you make of the fact that there wasn't the breaking of the door down or some sort of forced entry into the home? Is that a point that matters here to the defense, to the prosecution? Is that going to be a point? And is that a point where the defense could go down another road with it? Let's just start there with it. Is it a point? Is it anything other than the door is unlocked?
Well, Tony, as you said, as defense counsel, especially in a case where there appears to be substantial damning evidence, you have to play the hand you're dealt. And so this is a card in that hand. And so defense is going to look at that and say, hey, could that mean that someone who actually knew the Tepe family, who was invited into the home, who had access, who had a key, something like that, a neighbor, a friend, a coworker, family member, who knows, does it give rise to a potential alternative suspect? or at least is it evidence consistent with an alternative suspect either being let in or having access to the house and then committed these murders when it was not defendant McKee? That's the way defense might look at it.
So they're planting the seed of doubt.
Sure. Yeah, they got to play the hand they're dealt, and that's one way to play this otherwise somewhat crummy hand.
We've seen no evidence of this yet. This is just 1,000% pure conjecture. And there's obviously, we haven't seen anything of it because they probably don't even know of it yet. And maybe they do. Maybe it's in evidence. Maybe the digital footprint's going to be very interesting. If this is a big if, because we do not know anything about this, and I'm not basing this on any sort of anything. This is just coming from the ether of my brain. If we find that there was some sort of communication between Monique and McKee over these 8 years, and I'm not saying it in any sort of way of like leading him on or yeah, anything of that nature. I'm not going down that. I'm just saying anything of just, you know, kind of keeping him at bay, messages like that, just, you know.
And he's taking it as a breadcrumb.
Yeah. That's kind of what I'm wondering about. I'm saying if there is communication, obviously it'll depend what it is, but if there is any sort of communication, minimal at best, let's say there's just minimal breadcrumbs like that. Does that play well for McKee or does that hurt McKee in the end in something like this, if there's anything?
In my appraisal, it hurts them. And that could be regardless of the content of those communications. And what I mean is that a big question when this case started was, what's this guy's motive? Why would he care about some person from whom he was divorced like 9 years ago? It's been so attenuated. People move on with their lives. Well, this answers that question. Communication, if it exists, is bridges that temporal link to say, hey, actually, Monique was on McKee's mind. And for years after this, it goes to motive and it shows that he is still kept in contact with her, was thinking about her. And that sort of answers the question of why, you know, how could a person who divorced 9 years ago still be involved in this? Well, these communications, if they exist, allegedly show that involvement.
Are you surprised by the sloppy nature of this? I mean, there are certain pieces to this that are very rigid and very specific as to how things were done if he did this, but there's also just sloppiness. The overlooking that, you know, there's Ring cameras everywhere, that there's security cameras everywhere you go, that you're going to be tracked, that changing your license plate isn't going to work like it did 30 years ago, that leaving your phone somewhere isn't really going to do that. It's going to look more suspicious. Does this read to you as something that was well thought out and well planned for 8 years? Or does this read to you more like I'm angry and I'm going to be completely running on adrenaline here as I go and do this sort of thing? I don't know, because I'm surprised by the amount of F-ups that we're seeing in this alleged plot, if in fact it's created by this person who, you know, genuinely does have some intelligence to him, but maybe just not so much in terms of socially or how the world works.
To me, it strikes me, Tony, as kind of an amateur criminal smart guy. So he's got intelligence. He's a doctor. And perhaps he thought he was smarter than he really is. I'm not aware of any criminal history for this gentleman that's been publicly disclosed. And so someone who's not, you know, in this world, that they're not a professional assassin or something, they think, hey, I'm a pretty smart dude. I can navigate this and get away with it. They often overlook these what might be glaringly obvious signs and indications that they could be caught. Sometimes they don't think about it. Sometimes they think, I've taken other precautions that are going to protect me or whatever. But it kind of strikes me as someone who thought they were smarter than they really were, but were truly kind of a novice when it comes to criminality.
What about the end game here? If the defense looks at this case and decides they probably can't win an outright acquittal, too much evidence, too much publicity. There's a lot of it here, obviously. Mm-hmm. What is a fallback? Is there a lesser path here, lesser charges that might be a win? Could this go from aggravated murder to manslaughter through negotiation? Obviously, the death penalty, technically, it could be on the table. It does exist in the state, but it hasn't been used forever. So maybe probably isn't going to really be a thing. So trying to get that off the table, not necessarily the end goal here. What do you do? I mean, is there any other avenue here that you can go down when you have this level of evidence that's going against you? And we know how it's going to read in court, no matter how you try and spin it. Is there an insanity defense? I mean, I think that's one hell of a bridge to try and get that far on, considering what it looks like the amount of premeditation. But I don't know. I mean, is there any other road you can see this going other than it's just... it's going to be a train wreck that attorney's going to, you know, really be interesting to watch to see what they present in court. But at the end of the day, it is what it is. And even the best attorneys, you know, they can come up against a brick wall.
Yeah, I mean, defense has to explore alibi, whether they can prove that McKee was somewhere else with someone else. They've got to explore possible alternative suspects and say, hey, who could possibly have a motive and the opportunity to do this? They've got to look at possible not guilty by reason of insanity. I haven't seen any significant evidence of that. But if they hit a brick wall, you know, typically they would try to sort of posture for some sort of lesser offense with some sort of cap on the amount of prison time that isn't life without the possibility of parole. Because if you get a cap on it, you get a number of years, sometimes that number goes down with good time, with earned time, with things that happen at the facilities, with rehabilitation. You look at that, but I think the kicker here, Tony, is that there were two deaths. If there was one death, I think it would be a lot more likely that they might be able to get some kind of leniency, even if it was a modicum of leniency. With two deaths, it's going to be a stretch.
Yeah. Yeah, it's going to be a wild ride to watch.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Brewski and the Hidden Killers podcast.